Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, December 11th, 2021 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane. Today, we will be reading from the following main articles. DIA Terminal Renovation, Airport Makes $1.1 Billion Pitch by John Murray, the Denver Post. Flavored Tobacco, Denver Mayor Vetoes Ban by Noel Phillips, the Denver Post. Economy, Consumer Prices Rose at Fastest Pace Since 1982 by Gina Smialik, the New York Times. Making Do, Meager Snowfall Still an Issue for Colorado Ski Resorts as Christmas Looms by John Meyer, the Denver Post. And following up with miscellaneous articles. DIA Terminal Renovation, Airport Makes $1.1 Billion Pitch. Officials Asked to Add Contracts That Would Double Project's Cost by John Murray, the Denver Post. Denver International Airport officials have decided to go big in their quest to finish the terminal renovation project, unveiling proposed contract additions that would send the $770 million endeavor soaring to nearly $1.9 billion. If approved, the additional work would extend construction out from 2024 through 2028, potentially a full decade after the Great Hall project construction got underway. The upshot from $1.1 billion in proposed contract additions disclosed late Thursday to the Denver City Council is that DIA is seeking to add back several major components that officials cut from the project once it ran into budget and schedule turbulence early on. Those include full relocation of the main security checkpoints and completion of new check-in areas for all airlines. After terminating the original project team, DIA officials reduced the scope to keep it within a revised budget of $770 million, which accounted for the original $650 million budget and a $120 million contingency fund for unforeseen costs or overruns. At the time, then-CEO Kim Day repeatedly promised to hold the line. But DIA's pitch now is that all of the work will be needed in coming years to keep up with rapid growth in passenger traffic, which has been disrupted only by the coronavirus pandemic. DIA, in part because it serves as a domestic connecting hub for several airlines, has seen one of the quickest recoveries among U.S. airports, recently approaching 2019 levels of traffic. Next year, we are expecting to exceed where we were pre-COVID, DIA spokeswoman Stacy Stegman told the Denver Post Friday. Our growth is still happening, and as one of the fastest growing and busiest airports in the world, we have to plan now to be ready for the future. The longer we wait, the harder it's going to get. We have an opportunity right now, with construction underway on earlier phases, to build this out before it becomes so difficult and even more impactful for passengers in the future. DIA produced summaries of the proposed contract amendments, which were submitted to the council, reveal a gargantuan scope that's well beyond anything discussed publicly until now. City Council consideration is set to begin at a meeting of the Business and Aviation Services Committee on Wednesday afternoon. DIA will need approval from a council that's both expressed a reluctance to throw more money at a big project and lamented that core components were trimmed back. I personally have some concerns about the amount of money that they're asking for and the consequences of what that would do to our bond rating and our cost per enplaned passenger, etc., Councilwoman Amanda Sawyer said, citing airlines' operating costs at DIA. She added that she understood the importance of finishing the upgrades to the largest economic driver in the region. I haven't decided how I'll vote yet, Sawyer said. Councilman Kevin Flynn, who chairs the committee, says he still wants the city to conduct a lessons-learned analysis of the original project's failure, as well as more details about how much further we actually need to go. He wants to see a more detailed accounting of the project costs, he said, adding that the highest priority for many of us is the complete relocation of TSA security screening areas. After firing the original team in 2019, DIA reworked the project. Officials jettisoned the planned relocation of one of two main security checkpoints to the upper level. They reduced by roughly half the work planned to expand and reconfigure airline check-in areas, which leaves airlines with smaller footprints cramped at old ticket counters, and they eliminated the repurposing of the lower level, where most security screening is now, into a larger passenger meeting and greeting space. But earlier this year, DIA officials said they were examining ways to restore the second security move in a final phase of the project. Some council members were among those who expressed misgivings that the security relocations were scaled back, since the vulnerability of the main floor checkpoints from balconies was among the motivating factors behind the project. The contract documents reveal plans to essentially restore nearly all of the major components to their original scope, including the security relocations and check-in area expansions, and at much higher costs than contemplated several years back. One part that Stegman says is not in line for revival, a controversial original plan to fill part of the lower level where security is now with shops and outlets that would make for a post-security mall of sorts. Plans have changed in the last 2 years, so the passengers screened up on level 6 would take long escalators straight down to the concourse train platform, bypassing level 5. It's all about efficiency and creating a better experience for people as they travel through, Stegman said. She said officials expect the years of continuing work would be less disruptive for passengers, since parts of the project occurring in the center of the terminal were wrapped up this fall. Additional work would be more out of the way, she said. The contracts include one notable proposed new addition, the building of a Center of Excellence and Equity in Aviation on a lower level of the airport's Hotel and Transit Center, located just south of the terminal. It's unclear how much that component would cost. It's an idea contributed by new CEO Phil Washington. When he was appointed by Mayor Michael Hancock last summer, Washington said in an interview that he hoped to create programs aimed at encouraging young people, especially young people of color, to pursue careers in aviation and other airport-related fields. Stegman added Friday that the goal is to build a pipeline for aviation talent in the future. DIA, which operates as a city enterprise, would pay for the expanded terminal work by tapping or borrowing against its own revenues. They largely come from fees assessed on airlines, passengers, and concessionaires. Huge increases for four contracts. The contract additions for the four contractors brought in to restart the project in early 2020, led by Hensel Phelps Construction, would dwarf their original values. Hensel Phelps Construction Management and General Contracting deal would expand from a $365 million to a nearly $1.3 billion maximum, a $900 million increase. Stantec Architecture's $33.1 million contractual maximum would increase by $100 million. Jacobs Engineering's $52 million maximum would increase by $50 million. Engineer consulting firm L.S. Gallegos's $38 million maximum for project management and support also would increase by $50 million. The proposed contract amendments also would expand the scope of work without a new bid process. There's never been a full bid for the restarted project since DIA selected Hensel Phelps in late 2019 from among three contractors that had experience working at the airport. That setup was chosen to streamline the process. Stegman said Friday that soliciting new bidders for the future work likely would pose too many complications for the project. As for cost estimates that have increased way beyond the original project, even with many of the same components, Stegman cited soaring costs for materials and labor, as well as early cost projections by the original contracting team that proved to be wrong. I would venture to say that our estimates of completing the originally proposed Great Hall project were unrealistic, she said. This is the position that we are in now to be able to get this done. As he took over as CEO this year, Washington pledged to review DIA's extensive capital needs and keep projects under control. He's overseen big projects before as the top official at the Regional Transportation District from 2009 to 2015, and most recently at the Los Angeles Metro Transit Agency in California. But the DIA job is his first at an airport. Future growth prospects have complicated attempts to rein in the projects at DIA, which opened in 1995. In recent months, Washington announced an initiative called Vision 100, a nod to projections that DIA would achieve the milestone of 100 million passengers per year in the next decade or so, rising from a record 69 million in 2019. Other projects that predate Washington include new gates under construction on all three concourses, all set to be done within 6 months or so, and prep work for a seventh runway, which will take several years to build. Day, the previous CEO, retired in July after 13 years in charge of the airport, which grew to become the fifth busiest in the United States in terms of passenger traffic in 2019. Amid the scrambled travel dynamics of the pandemic, DIA clocked the third highest passenger traffic in the world in the first 6 months of 2021, according to data gathered by Airports Council International. Original project was supposed to be done now. The Great Hall project got underway in mid-2018, with completion targeted for late 2021, right about now. That didn't happen. By early 2019, project squabbling took root over costs and delays between airport brass and the contracting team, Great Hall Partners, led by Madrid-based Ferrovial Airports and Centennial-based Saunders Construction. Airport officials and Ferrovial traded accusations about project performance, oversight problems, and meddling that led to delays and projected overruns. DIA and city officials terminated the contractor's $1.8 billion deal in August 2019. That setup was a more complex public-private partnership, and it included a $650 million renovation as well as fees and revenue sharing during 3 decades of oversight of expanded concession spaces in the terminal. When it restarted the project, the airport adopted a more straightforward contracting approach. Since the reset, the Great Hall project has chugged along. In late October, the mayor joined airport and airline officials to cut the ribbon on Phase 1, which brought new multi-sided check-in spaces for United and Southwest Airlines to the middle sections of the east and west sides of the building's Level 6. Phase 2 is underway and will relocate the South Level 5 Transportation Security Administration screening checkpoint upstairs to an expanded part of the terminal's northwest corner. Carrying out the same relocation of the North Level 6 checkpoint to the northeast corner would require the extension of the floor plate farther into the atrium, as is happening now on the other side. Flavored tobacco. Denver mayor vetoes ban. Hancock says bill would be toothless. Advocates outraged. By Noel Phillips, The Denver Post. Denver Mayor Michael Hancock used his veto power for only the second time in his tenure to block a bill that would have banned the sale of most flavored tobacco and vaping projects in the city in 2023, drawing criticism from those who say the mayor chose to put profits over a public health crisis. Hancock sent a letter Friday morning to City Council that said a Denver ban would be ineffective because surrounding counties would still allow sales and it would harm small businesses. He declined to speculate on whether the council will override his veto during their Monday night meeting. But the mayor offered to work on a compromise, including boosting enforcement of existing laws in the coming year. I believe in passing and implementing effective policies, Hancock said in an interview with the Denver Post. I didn't see that this bill singling Denver out would do anything to keep nicotine and vaping products from our young people. Public health advocates, who argued the ban is a necessary step to curb an epidemic among teens, blasted Hancock's veto. There is no excuse for Mayor Hancock vetoing this critical ordinance, siding with Big Tobacco over Denver's kids and the 100-plus organizations who support this policy. Jody Radke, regional director for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, said in an emailed statement, In the letter to council, Hancock wrote that it would be more effective and appropriate to pursue a statewide ban through the legislature. He told the Denver Post he has reached out to the city's legislators to encourage them to draft a bill that would outlaw flavored smoking products across Colorado. Denver is one of dozens of cities in our metro area, and absent similar bans in our neighboring communities, it is not a prohibitive enough barrier if our youth are simply able to travel across Denver's border to the nearest convenience store and obtain flavored tobacco products, the letter said. We cannot appropriately address the public health impacts of youth tobacco use if that public health response occurs only in Denver. Hancock also said the ban would destroy many small, minority-owned retail stores. If we were to institute this ban only within our jurisdiction, many local businesses and business owners would experience a severe drop in their income. Some may choose to locate to other jurisdictions where such a ban is not in place, and others would have to close their businesses entirely, leaving their employees out of a job. This economic disruption will be felt by Denver alone, the letter said. The veto was cheered by those who opposed the ban. I can say we are breathing a sigh of relief today, Monica Vendrusco, owner of Signot, a vape shop in northwest Denver, said. We are happy to hear Hancock wants to work with us instead of just putting us out of business. Denver City Council approved the ban on most flavored tobacco, including menthol cigarettes and vaping products, on December 6th, and the ban would have been effective in July 2023. Under the law, adults in Denver only would be able to buy flavored smoking products in hookah lounges and cigar and pipe shops. The idea to ban flavored smoking products originated with Councilwoman Amanda Sawyer, who said the conversation started after her teen daughter was included in a text message chain with classmates who were trying to illegally buy flavored vaping products. After Hancock announced his veto, Sawyer and the bill's co-sponsor, Debbie Ortega, blasted Hancock's decision in a statement saying, "We are disappointed in this outcome, but we don't think anyone in Denver will be surprised to hear that our mayor chose profit over people." In an interview with the Denver Post, Sawyer said, "It's a public health issue. It's an epidemic among our children. It's been named an epidemic by the Surgeon General." The issue pitted health advocates against big tobacco, mom-and-pop smoke shops, and hookah lounges. But those latter groups also didn't agree on how the bill should be written, often lobbying for their own interests rather than joining forces against the ban. Council's debate over the ban stretched for months, and lobbyists put pressure on the city's politicians to vote in their favor. Some council members said it was the most heated proposal they'd seen in years, and the various interested groups spent big bucks on the cause. The original bill was amended to allow hookah lounges and cigar shops to keep selling flavored products. Hancock said he didn't agree with the strategy to carve out exceptions. Moreover, providing an exemption for natural cigars and hookah lounges puts us in a position of not only picking winners and losers in this ban, but also raises equity concerns that certain businesses and residents should not face the burdens this ban will place on others, the letter to council said. The Friday veto was only the second time Hancock has used that executive power in his 10-year tenure. He vetoed a bill in 2020 that would have repealed the city's ban on pit bulls. Later that year, the city's voters overturned the ban on the dog breed. Council needs 9 votes to override the veto, and it is unclear whether there will be enough support to do so on Monday. The bill was approved 8-3 with 2 members absent. One of those who was absent, Chris Herndon, has said he opposed the ban. The other council member who missed the vote, Kevin Flynn, has proposed amendments to the ban, but his office said he is on vacation with limited access to email in order to comment. Hancock and vape shop owners said Friday they would be willing to revisit the issue in 2022, and Hancock promised to use existing laws as a blunt instrument. "We ought to treat tobacco products similar to how we treat alcohol and marijuana. If you're selling to people who are underage, you could lose your license, period," the mayor said. Phil Guerin, owner of Mixed Up Vaping Store on East Colfax Avenue, said council overreached in its effort to stop youth vaping. He advocates vape products as a safe alternative for those who want to quit smoking cigarettes. The 30 small business vaping stores in Denver want to be treated like the marijuana shops, Guerin said in a statement. We all use strict safety protocols, such as ID scanners, video recordings, and other measures to ensure that youth do not purchase flavored vaping products. But Sawyer doubts anything will change if the veto stands. Denver doesn't have the capacity to regulate vaping products in the same manner the state regulates marijuana laws. And if the mayor wanted to use his executive powers to curb sales, he would have done so, Sawyer said. We've been having these conversations for a year, she said. Something could have been done before now. Economy. Consumer prices rose at fastest pace since 82, by Gina Smialek, The New York Times. Inflation jumped to the highest level in nearly 40 years, fresh data released Friday showed, as supply chain disruptions, rapid consumer demand, and rising housing costs combined to fuel the strongest inflationary burst in a generation. The rising costs spell trouble for officials at the Federal Reserve and the White House, who are trying to calibrate policy at a moment when the labor market has yet to completely heal from the pandemic, but inflation is proving more persistent than policymakers had expected. The Consumer Price Index climbed by 6.8% in the year through November, the data showed, the fastest pace since 1982. After stripping out food and fuel, which can move around a lot from month to month, inflation climbed by 4.9%. That was the quickest annual reading since 1991. Monthly price increases, the change between October and November rather than over the past year, did moderate somewhat, but still rose at an unusually rapid pace. The question is what happens next. Fed officials have become increasingly concerned about price increases, both because the uptick has lasted longer than expected and because it shows signs of broadening to areas less affected by the pandemic, suggesting it could become entrenched. Earlier this year, price increases were concentrated in goods. Used cars and couches were in demand as the pandemic changed people's lifestyles, but factories around the world struggled to keep up with the surge in buying, in part because shutdowns tied to the virus upended production. Shipping routes and ports also became clogged as demand followed an atypical pattern, with too many U.S.-bound goods trying to leave Asia in particular. Those disruptions were expected to be temporary. Instead, they have lasted for months as demand for goods remains strong and the virus continues to disrupt manufacturing and transportation. As pandemic quirks persist, inflationary pressures are also broadening to areas that are not directly impacted by the virus. That includes rental prices, which have surged after an initial slackening during the pandemic and are helping to push up overall price gains. It's a worrying development for the Fed as it considers its next policy steps. Generally, the higher prices we're seeing are related to the supply and demand imbalances that can be traced directly back to the pandemic and the reopening of the economy. But it's also the case that price increases have spread much more broadly in the recent few months, Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, said during congressional testimony late last month. I think the risk of higher inflation has increased. Fed officials are closely watching what happens with wages and with consumer inflation expectations as they try to gauge when and how much inflation will fade, but they are also starting to acknowledge that they might have to react to rising prices. Powell signaled last week that the Fed, which laid out a plan to begin cutting back on economic support last month, will discuss speeding up that process at its December 14th and 15th meetings. Economists expect central bankers to announce a plan to slow down their monthly bond purchases fast enough so that the program ends several months earlier, putting Fed officials in a position to raise their benchmark interest rate, their more traditional and more powerful tool. Friday's data will keep policymakers on track to accelerate their plans to taper off bond purchases, said Alan Detmeister, a senior economist at UBS and former chief of the Wages and Prices Division at the Fed Board in Washington. This is still an enormous, a very, very strong number, Detmeister said, explaining that while he expects inflation to moderate, it may take until the middle of next year for that to show up clearly in the year-over-year data. It seems pretty clear that they're going to speed up the taper, he added. Moving to the next step, raising rates would make debt of all kinds, from mortgages to car and business loans, more expensive. That would likely slow spending and hiring, cooling off demand, and weighing down buoyant housing costs. The combination could help to put a lid on price gains, but it could also leave the country with a less competitive labor market. That could be bad if the millions of people who remain out of the labor market compared to before the pandemic, many of them because of childcare issues and other virus-tied concerns, decide to embark on a job hunt. As housing and other day-to-day costs rise, workers may begin to ask for raises to help offset the financial blow. Climbing wages can feed into inflation as companies pass rising labor costs onto consumers and as bigger paychecks help households to keep spending, sustaining consumer demand. Data show that pay is climbing briskly. Employers are competing for laborers at a time when job openings far exceed the number of people actively looking for jobs, and they are lifting pay to attract and retain workers. The Employment Cost Index, a measure the Fed watches closely, picked up notably in the three-month period that ended in September. Wages are rising especially rapidly for low earners, though they have not kept up with the acceleration in prices for most workers in recent months. Still, continued government benefits, including an expanded child tax credit, may mean that families are better positioned to afford climbing expenses. Because consumers have had the wherewithal to spend, companies have been managing to charge more, protecting and even increasing their bottom lines as input costs climb. Profit margins for non-financial companies have been increasing this year, including some of the industries hardest hit by supply problems. We are actually seeing that the price increases that we've put through as a result of covering the costs that we're getting from input product and freight is being absorbed by the customer, Bruce K. Thorne, chief executive officer at Big Lots, said on the December 3rd earnings call, later adding that we're not seeing that resistance. Making do. Meager snowfall still an issue for Colorado ski resorts as Christmas looms. By John Meyer, The Denver Post. With the crucial holiday break drawing near for resorts, Colorado skiers and snowboarders are bemoaning meager snowfall so far this season. Tourists have been shocked to find bare ground at resort base areas and in nearby ski towns, with limited terrain offerings on the slopes above, and most of that is on man-made snow. The south side of Loveland Pass, which normally would be crisscrossed by the tracks of backcountry skiers this time of year, was unskiable on Tuesday. Two women from Denver hiked three-quarters of the way up to the 13,000-foot ridge east of the pass wearing hiking boots. One of them, Sydney Hecht, had skied Vail, Breckenridge, and Keystone last weekend and found them not too great, although she was happy to get in some turns. There were very few lifts open, Hecht said. They were pretty icy and super crowded. But a random sampling of skiers and snowboarders this week across Summit County and in Vail suggested many are taking conditions in stride. Visitors understood that snowfall so far this year has been disappointing, but most seemed grateful for the opportunity to ski and ride. Brian Sunnerberg, an avid skier from the East Coast who moved to Colorado this year, was thrilled with the experience he had at Copper Mountain on Tuesday. Less than 10% of the mountain's terrain was open, but a shot of snow overnight freshened the slopes that were in operation. Having grown up skiing in New England gave him a perspective Colorado natives might not have. "For me, this in December is incredible," Sunnerberg said. "People have been complaining about how there's been no snow, and it's been a late start to the season. But for me, going on December 7th, skiing in 6 inches of fresh snow, and going into the woods a little bit, it was awesome." Phil Francavilla, who came out from Long Island, New York, went snowboarding at Breckenridge, Keystone, and Vail. He was shocked to see how little snow there was compared to the last time he was here 2 years ago, but that season had abundant early season snowfall. The first Colorado ski areas opened that year on October 11th and 12th, which were the earliest openings in Colorado since 2009, and the backcountry was already skiable the last week of October. That was our first powder experience out west, Frank Avila said. Not only great, amazing. Frank Avila had a good time this week, though, especially at Vail, where he found the conditions awesome. Slopes not covered by snowmaking at the bottom of Vail Mountain were showing a lot of grass, but there was good skiing and riding at the top of the mountain. East Coast snowboarding stinks too right now, so I can say I had a ton of fun on an out west snowboard trip, Frank Avila said. I'll come back in a few weeks and do it all over again, even if there's not that much snow on the ground. Jen Jefferson of Genesee said she found conditions at Breckenridge mediocre when she skied last weekend. Her family owns a condo there. I know they're doing their best, trying to make snow, and I am a ski snob anyway, Jefferson said. It's early season, but I think this is par for the course compared to what we are seeing the past several years. If 2 weeks from now we are still in the same spot, I'd be alarmed. Richard Snyder has owned Daylight Donuts, an institution on Main Street in Breckenridge, for more than 20 years. He said he hasn't talked to other business owners about how snow conditions have been affecting them, but he did say his numbers have been normal to above average. And, being a longtime local, he wasn't panicking despite the dearth of big snows, especially with a significant storm anticipated before the weekend. This is not too far off of normal, Snyder said. What happens normally this time of year, there will be not much snow, and then all of a sudden we'll get like a 3-footer or a 4-footer. It seems like just 2 or 3 years ago, the ski resort was going to open late, and boom, we got like 3 feet of snow. All of a sudden, everything was good. We just need like 1 or 2 little storms before Christmas to keep everybody happy. Therese Dayton, whose family has owned the Breckenridge Nordic Center for more than 50 years, shared the same perspective. About 8 of the 30 kilometers are open for cross-country skiing and snowshoeing. Anyone who has lived here for any amount of time will tell you they're not worried about it at all, Dayton said. It's the newer people or the newer businesses. Their rent is high and everybody wants it now because the rent is due. If you talk to any of the longtime local skiers, none of them are worried about it. They just get creative and go into the backcountry. But that's not something all of our visitors can do. So for the people we serve, we do have enough. Conditions for backcountry touring have been poor, though. Only a few trails in the Summit County Vail area were skiable this week, although one, Mayflower Gulch, located 6 miles south of Copper Mountain, was in almost perfect condition on Tuesday. We could really use some snow, said Adam Bianchi, district ranger for the Dillon District of the White River National Forest. I would say for people to set their expectations realistically. There's not a ton of great snow, but you can still get out snowshoes, tour on skis a little bit. People are eager and finding ways to enjoy the little bit of snow we have. Buzz Schlepper moved to Vail from Minnesota in 1972. The longtime owner of Buzz's ski shop and Buzz's boards said he can't recall a year when there was so little early season snow there. Even so, his business is up over last year. Thanks to snowmaking, Schlepper said he has skied every day since Vail opened on November 12th. I grew up in Minnesota on man-made ice, Schlepper said. They really know how to blow good snow here. It's soft, you can edge, and the coverage is good. There's no rocks on the runs that are open. It's limited because of the lack of snow, but inbounds on the runs that are open, it is as good as it gets. Only 10% of Vail's 5,317 acres of skiable terrain was open as of Thursday. Still, pro skier Chris Anthony, who has appeared in more than 24 Warren Miller ski films, went on Tuesday for his first day on skis this season and said he was incredibly pleasantly surprised, adding that he skied a lot of runs on 2 trails covered with man-made snow. They did a smart thing a few years ago. They moved the snowmaking up to the top. Higher elevations, colder temperatures, so they're able to do a better job, Anthony said. The runs that had snowmaking were awesome, and we just got 5 inches on top of that. In the old days, you'd be hitting rocks. I didn't hit one rock. After a slow start, resorts have had colder temperatures in recent weeks to assist snowmaking efforts. Beaver Creek last week hosted Olympic-caliber World Cup ski racing on a downhill course that is 1.5 miles long with a vertical drop of 2,470 feet. That's a lot of man-made snow, and the races were a success. "The conditions were perfect," said Anthony, who attended the races. "I always thought it was kind of a miracle if we were skiing a lot before Thanksgiving," said Anthony, a Colorado native. "I always thought we were lucky if we had good conditions on Thanksgiving. I've always thought we marketed the season too early to begin with. Hopefully in December, usually the snow really starts to come in, and then you pray for a great Christmas, which usually happens. Skiing in October and early November is kind of bizarre. I think our expectations have grown a little beyond what nature can provide us," he said. "It's going to come, hopefully sooner than later." Abortion. Justices won't stop Texas ban. Clinics still able to sue. By Mark Sherman, The Associated Press. Washington. The Supreme Court on Friday left in place Texas's ban on most abortions, offering only a glimmer of daylight for clinics in the state to challenge the nation's most restrictive abortion law. The decision, little more than a week after the court signaled it would roll back abortion rights and possibly overturn its landmark Roe v. Wade decision, was greeted with dismay by abortion rights supporters but praised by opponents. Five conservative judges, including three appointed by former President Donald Trump, formed a majority to limit who can be sued by the clinics, a result that both sides said probably will prevent federal courts from effectively blocking the law. Texas licensing officials may be sued, but not state court judges, court clerks, or State Attorney General Ken Paxton, the court ruled. That seems to leave people free, under the unusual structure of the Texas law, to sue abortion clinics and anyone else who aids or abets an abortion performed after cardiac activity is detected in an embryo, around 6 weeks and before some women know they're pregnant. The Supreme Court has essentially greenlit Texas's cynical scheme and prevented federal courts from blocking an unconstitutional law. The Center for Reproductive Rights, which represents the Texas clinics, said on Twitter, "The court acted more than a month after hearing arguments over the law, which makes no exceptions for rape or incest. The law has been in place for about 3 months, since September 1st. The Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade ruling that legalized abortion nationwide has stood since 1973. President Joe Biden voiced concern over the high court decision to keep the Texas law in effect and restated his support for legislation that has cleared the House of Representatives and would codify in federal law the abortion right now at risk. "We have more work to do, but I will always stand with women to protect and defend their long-recognized constitutional right under Roe v. Wade," Biden said in a statement. Justice Neil Gorsuch, who has consistently voted against abortion rights, did not mention Roe in his main opinion for the court Friday. Gorsuch is one of the Trump appointees, along with Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett. Abortion providers will now attempt to run the same legal gauntlet that has previously frustrated them. The federal judge who already has once blocked the law, known as SB 8, almost certainly will be asked to do so again. Then his decision would be reviewed by the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which has twice voted to allow enforcement of the abortion ban. In any case, it all could return to the justices, and so far there have not been 5 votes on the 9-member court to put the law on hold while the legal fight plays out. The court should have put an end to this madness months ago, before SB 8 first went into effect. It failed to do so then, and it fails again today, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote in a separate opinion Friday. The court's conservative majority also seems likely to roll back abortion rights in a Mississippi case that was argued last week, although that decision is not expected until spring. If Roe is overruled, the fight over the Texas law would be largely beside the point because Texas is one of 12 states with a trigger law that would ban abortion in a post-Roe world. Friday's high court ruling came a day after a state court judge in Texas ruled that the law's enforcement, which rewards lawsuits against violators by awarding judgments of $10,000, is unconstitutional, yet left the law in place. Critics of the decision also said it would encourage other states to adopt copycat laws on abortion and allow for attacks on other constitutional rights. The legal fight over the Texas law is focused on its unusual structure and whether it improperly limits how the law can be challenged in court. Texas lawmakers handed responsibility for enforcing the law to private citizens rather than state officials. The law authorizes lawsuits against clinics, doctors, and others who perform or facilitate a banned abortion. The case raised a complex set of issues about who, if anyone, can sue over the law in federal court, the typical route for challenges to abortion restrictions. Indeed, federal courts routinely put a hold on similar laws, which rely on traditional enforcement by state and local authorities. The Supreme Court voted 8-1 in favor of allowing the clinic's lawsuit against the ban to proceed, with only Justice Clarence Thomas voting the other way. But the court was sharply divided, 5-4 on the knotty issue of whom to target with a court order that ostensibly tries to block the law. The justices ruled that Texas licensing officials may be sued, but dismissed claims against state court judges, court clerks, and the state attorney general. Gorsuch wrote that abortion providers have to follow the same rules that apply to people asserting other constitutional rights. The court has consistently applied these requirements whether the challenged law in question is said to chill the free exercise of religion, the freedom of speech, the right to bear arms, or any other right. The petitioners are not entitled to a special exemption, Gorsuch wrote. Chief Justice John Roberts and the three liberal justices dissented from that part of the decision in an opinion that said the purpose of the Texas law was to nullify this court's rulings on abortion. Food service. Districts need federal help to continue lunch programs. By Yesenia Robles, Chalkbeat, Colorado. When the Jefferson County School District expects a food shipment, usually at least one item is missing. Food Services Director Beth Wallace said her team typically gets a heads up about the missing products the day before the truckload arrives at the warehouse. We ask what they have available, and we usually accept it. Otherwise, we will not have food, Wallace said. The alternative might cost $4 more per case, but Wallace will take it. When nothing is available, or the alternative doesn't arrive in time, food service workers dig through the district's warehouse to find something they can serve. It's been a difficult year overall, food service directors told a panel hosted by No Kid Hungry and the School Nutrition Association Thursday morning, but planning for the next school year is also proving stressful. As they plan for next year, with expected continuing supply chain problems, they want the federal government to continue pandemic-era waivers that have allowed extra flexibility and increased funding for their school meal programs, Wallace and other food service directors said. The extra funding has been in the form of increased meal reimbursements. Food service directors said the increase has helped pay for the higher cost of food and to increase staff pay. Warren DeShields, director of food service at Bridgeton Public Schools, a largely Latino district in New Jersey, said if the waivers go away, then I don't know how we're going to stay afloat. Our students really need the food we provide, he added. DeShields and other food service directors say that although it takes more work and often involves food that is not their first choice, they have been able to get food to students. School districts are seeing higher participation rates, meaning more students are opting for a school lunch than in previous years. In Jeffco, the number of meals served increased to about 45,000 per day from about 30,000. Ensuring more students are prepared to learn because they have had a good meal is important, food directors said. Sometimes securing meals means getting food from different vendors, including those without existing contracts. That can mean it comes from farther away and at higher prices. DeShields said his planning has also meant rotating available food more often. For example, when he gets chicken patties, he might dress them up differently so students don't feel like they're eating the same meal week after week. Food service directors said they've seen how families have struggled feeding children during the pandemic. The flexibility they've had to serve meals outside of a traditional lunchroom meant parents had more insight into what their kids were getting to eat. Districts across the country used buses to deliver meals to family homes during remote learning. They were surprised at the quality of food and freshness and the variety, DeShields said. Students have also been served meals in classrooms, which allows for social distancing and also helps ensure all students have access to the meals. The higher reimbursement that directors on the panel asked the government to extend has meant districts could pay employees more to attract more applicants during the staff shortage. Jeffco schools normally operate with about 400 to 450 food service employees, but this year there are at least 100 fewer, Wallace said. It means there are fewer lines open and less food options for students. The district also has plans to have school staff serve pre-made meal kits for lunch when no food service employees are available. Wallace said Jeffco has raised its minimum wage for food service workers to $15 per hour from $13.25. She also said she expects to be able to offer a hiring bonus as early as next week. Another government flexibility has enabled districts to give free meals to all students, directors said. In Jeffco, where about 28% of the 70,000 students qualify for subsidized meals, Wallace said this year there has been no food shaming because no one knows which students qualify for free lunches. It has been a wonderful benefit of this program, Wallace said. The equity there has just been outstanding. Wallace said in Jeffco, she's heard students are grateful for being able to eat lunch every day. Thank you, miss. I used to be able to have lunch only twice a week. Now I can have lunch every day, Wallace said, a student told her. I really like when I hear from kids. Chalkbeat Colorado is a nonprofit news organization covering education issues. Metro Denver, inflation at a level not seen in years, by Otto Svaldi, The Denver Post. Metro Denver consumer prices are inflating at the fastest rate since 1983, putting a squeeze on household budgets that will be harder to escape, according to a bi-monthly update from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics on Friday. The consumer price index for the Denver-Aurora-Lakewood area rose 6.5% over the past year in November, which is up from a 4.5% annual pace in September and a 3.5% annual pace in July. It marks the highest inflation rate measured in Metro Denver since a 6.8% annual increase in May 1983. Metro Denver's inflation rate came in below the 6.8% annual pace measured nationally in November. That rate was the highest in 39 years. If you are younger than 40 years old, then you have never experienced such high inflation, said Lawrence Yun, chief economist with the National Association of Realtors, in comments on Friday's inflation numbers. Yun expects that rising inflation could force the Federal Reserve to push up interest rates, which in turn could drive up housing costs, the largest cost category for consumers, via higher mortgage rates. The cost for shelter is up 4.9% the past year in Metro Denver. Gasoline prices are the source of the greatest sticker shock, up 63.9% this past year. But gasoline prices were down 3.3% between September and November, a sign they may have topped out. But price increases are coming in another energy commodity, natural gas. Although the Denver Index doesn't itemize natural gas, prices are up 25% nationally and household energy costs are up 7.5%, while electricity costs are up a more modest 2.4%. Used car prices continue to defy gravity, up 32.6% over the past year and 5.2% the past 2 months alone, a sign that shortages in the vehicle market don't appear to be easing. A separate study from iccars.com, a vehicle search engine, estimates used car prices are up 23.5% year over year in Metro Denver, which has added $6,082 in additional costs compared to a comparable sale a year earlier. The food price index in Denver was up 4.4% the past year, with food at home costs up 2.8% and the cost of eating out up 6.7%. Among food items, price increases were highest for meat, poultry, fish, and eggs, up 6.5%, followed by baked products and cereals, up 3.6%. Dairy products were nearly flat, up 0.3%, while prices for fruits and vegetables were down 1.2% the past year. Other areas with annual price gains above the 6.5% overall inflation rate include auto insurance, up 6.7%, clothing, up 8.1%, non-durable goods, not including food, up 17.1%, and durable or long-lasting goods, up 10.9%. Core inflation or consumer items, less energy and foods, is up 5.2%. COVID-19, National Guard helping ailing states, hospitals, by Ed White, The Associated Press. More U.S. states desperate to defend against COVID-19 are calling on the National Guard and other military personnel to assist virus-weary medical staffs at hospitals and other care centers. People who became sick after refusing to get vaccinated are overwhelming hospitals in certain states, especially in the Northeast and the Upper Midwest. New York, meanwhile, announced a statewide indoor mask order effective Monday and lasting 5 weeks through the holiday season. We're entering a time of uncertainty, and we could either plateau here or our cases could get out of control, Governor Kathy Hochul warned Friday. In Michigan, Health Director Elizabeth Hertel was equally blunt. I want to be absolutely clear. You are risking serious illness, hospitalization, and even death without a vaccination. The 7-day rolling average for daily new cases in the U.S. rose over the past 2 weeks to 117,677 by Thursday, compared to 84,756 on November 25th. Thanksgiving Day, according to Johns Hopkins University. The number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 has soared to about 54,000 on average, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Meanwhile, the country is approaching a new milestone of 800,000 COVID-19 deaths. More than 200 million Americans, or about 60% of the population, are now fully vaccinated. In Maine, which hit a pandemic high this week with nearly 400 COVID-19 patients in hospitals, as many as 75 members of the National Guard were being summoned to try to keep people out of critical care with monoclonal antibodies and to perform other non-clinical tasks. Maine has one of the highest COVID-19 vaccinations in the country, 73%, but that rate lags in many of the state's rural pockets. The New York National Guard said it had deployed 120 Army medics and Air Force medical technicians to 12 nursing homes and long-term care facilities to relieve fatigued staff. Dr. Paolo Marciano, chief medical officer at Beaumont Hospital in Dearborn, Michigan, said it was a tremendous lifeline to get assistance from the Defense Department, which has more than 60 nurses, doctors, and respiratory therapists assigned to the state. It allowed us to be able to care for the COVID patients and at the same time still maintain the level of care that cancer patients require or people with chronic illnesses, Marciano said. Where we are today is really just keeping our heads above water. New York's mask order covers all indoor public places unless a business or venue has a vaccine requirement. The state reported more than 68,000 positive tests for the virus in a 7-day period that ended Wednesday, the most for any 7-day stretch since February. New York City and several upstate New York counties already have mask mandates. Critics, however, said the governor's announcement was another burden for businesses. Government overreach at its worst, said Republican Assemblyman Mike Lawler. Michigan is sending more ventilators to hospitals and asking for even more from the national stockpile. Infection rates and hospitalizations are at record levels, 21 months into the pandemic. The first case of the Omicron variant was confirmed Thursday in the Grand Rapids area. The largest hospital system in Indiana enlisted National Guard support this week at a time when the number of COVID-19 patients in the state has more than doubled in the past month. The state's COVID-19 hospitalizations are now higher than Indiana's summer surge that peaked in September and are approaching the pandemic peak reached in late 2020. FAA will stop handing out astronaut wings, by the Associated Press. Cape Canaveral, Florida. Heads up, future space travelers. No more commercial astronaut wings will be awarded from the Federal Aviation Administration after this year. The FAA said Friday it's clipping its astronaut wings because too many people are now launching into space. The news comes one day ahead of Blue Origin's planned liftoff from West Texas with former NFL player and TV celebrity Michael Strahan. He and his five fellow passengers will still be eligible for wings since the FAA isn't ending its long-standing program until January 1st. Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, December 11th, 2021 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane.